This is The Guardian.
Today, our culture critics on the biggest trends and the best of what's to come this autumn. Finally, it's happening. People are heading out. Audiences are in theatres, shows are selling fast, actual gigs and concerts are happening, and the world of entertainment seems to have cranked up several gears to give us plenty to feel excited about. For The Guardian's culture team, it's a huge relief. Critic Arifa Akbar remembers theatre getting pretty weird during lockdown.
I've had to get in a bathtub and take my phone in with me with my earplugs and do what the woman on the audio tape tells me to do in my bath. I've done theatre where you've got to shut every light in your home, put a blindfold on.
And with clubs shut, music editor Ben Beaumont Thomas had to take his spectacular dance moves elsewhere.
So I got kind of into this groove of dancing around my living room. My girlfriend would go to bed and I'd just have, you know, a small selection of craft beers, because obviously I'm a bearded Guardian journalist, and got really into this very driving 4/4 techno, glutted, amazing music. And yeah, it was me in my socks on the wooden floor.
Meanwhile, TV writer Amar Kalia surprised himself and everyone he knew by diving down a very highbrow rabbit hole.
Normally I just watch Neighbours. That's a continual rabbit hole for my life. But I actually read Svetlana Alexievich's book, Secondhand Time. I think it's like 800 pages long. It's very long, which is why it was its own kind of several months long rabbit hole for me.
Now, all three of them join me to celebrate the best of music, theatre and TV, and to discuss how the pandemic will shape the future of UK culture. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, going out or staying in, our critic's guide to the autumn. So I'm lucky to have two of you, Ben and Arifa, in the studio today. Amar is joining us down the line. And we're going to start with the most hyped releases, the ones with all the buzz. Ben, autumn usually delivers the music industry's biggest releases and tours. How true is that this year?
I think it's even more true than ever before, because you've had this situation where a lot of people have held records back, the biggest of all being Ed Sheeran's album Equals. My bad habits lead to late nights. You know, the first single, Bad Habits, was at number one for 10 weeks in the UK, and probably deservedly so. It was an incredibly well-written, powerfully melodic song that kind of demonstrates how sort of laser-guided and almost a little bit cynical Ed Sheeran is when it comes to songwriting. And then, yeah, from the US, there's a new album by The Weeknd, who's the first single from that. Take My Breath is an absolutely classic bit of disco pop. I saw the fire in your eyes. There's new albums by Cardi B and Lizzo and Coming. All the rumors are true, yeah. What you heard, that's true, yeah. Him and you, yeah. And definitely one of the records that people have been wildly excited for, and one of the most original voices in American pop music, is Lil Nas X, who has sort of gone from someone who people expected to be a complete one-hit wonder. And then, yeah, has just really grasped American pop culture and just enthralled everyone, and has done it in the most proudly queer way imaginable. Call me when you want, call me when you need, call me in the morning, I'll be on the way. Call me when you want, call me when you need, call me out by your name, I'll be on the way like you. And obviously we can't ignore perhaps the biggest record of the year, which is ABBA's Reunion. Do I have it in me? I believe it is in there. The first two songs are just ABBA incarnate and are just utterly, utterly joyous. The ballad is as lachrymose and cheesy and poignant as you'd want it to be. And then the kind of mid-tempo disco strut in your kind of gold lamé dress song is utterly exquisite. There was anticipation about this from pretty much the last 5 years when there's this hologram tour was mooted and everyone was thinking, are they going to make new music? And then they said they had recorded two songs. And then they said they've now recorded an entire album. And that's certainly something I'm excited for.
This month, you've got two of the world's biggest rappers, Kanye and Drake, reigniting their long-standing simmering beef. Both delayed the release of their albums and then bought them out in the same week. How have they gone down?
I think there's a lot of very vociferous criticism about both records. And I actually think it's slightly undeserved, especially in the case of Donda, which is the Kanye West record.
Donda.
You know, in The Guardian, we reviewed it with two stars. And
so it was savage, that was, review.
Yeah, and I think there were some valid points in that review. And I think that Kanye's sort of sense of witty metaphor has slightly fallen off, and you can definitely tell that he's a dad writing now, like, you know, lots of references to Lego and Buzz Lightyear and that sort of thing. It is metaphors. But I think that actually when people have had a little bit longer to sit with this record, the depths will really start to reveal themselves. Did she finally come to life? Ever wish you had another life? Ever wish you had another? The Drake album as well is another bloated record. And I think we're entering this phase now where people don't really necessarily bring things out on a CD or a vinyl, certainly in the rap sphere. So this has kind of, you know, loosened all of rappers' indulgences, basically, and these albums are sort of stretching to 20 tracks and over. There are some very ripe moments on this record, not least when he gets Future to cover I'm Too Sexy by Right Said Fred. I'm too sexy for this chain, too sexy for your game, too sexy for this fame. Yeah. Also the moment where Drake claims to be a lesbian. Yeah, say that you a lesbian, girl, me too. Hey, girls want girls where I'm from. Hey, which, it's just oral clickbait, essentially. But there's some really incredibly well-worked long-form freestyles on there. There's some beautiful production. Still a fascinating album, I think. Again, another one that people will spend time with and kind of create their own greatest hits from, perhaps.
Aretha, going from those giant pop star egos to the very shy and retiring Andrew Lloyd Webber, who is now at the centre of a season of productions. You've been to see his Cinderella the musical, which was delayed by several months because of the pandemic. What did you think?
Oh, Cinderella. So the first thing to say is I am an enormous, I'll admit it, an enormous Andrew Lloyd Webber fan. Cinderella was bigged up. And we had to wait, you know, there were a series of cancellations. So Andrew Lloyd Webber was not only fighting for his show and shouting for his show, in fairness, he was shouting for theatre and for the government to let us all back in.
We got to get theatre open up and down the country, everywhere, for all of the actors and the musicians and the technicians whose livelihood has been put completely on hold now for a year.
So we were let back in and some of the music was very good. There were some strong songs. The performances were fine. The sets were large and splashy.
There's a big butt coming, isn't there?
There's an enormous butt. It had a real panto feel, and there were a lot of panto villains. And I found the feminism to be really woefully dated. I've got to say it. You have a lot of women who look, I'm afraid, very, like, posh, stick-thin Chelsea women having a go at each other. I'm sorry, it reminded me of sort of Dynasty's Crystal and Alexis pushing each other in the pool.
It sounds amazing and terrible
things
at the same time.
It was, I think that to make every woman unpleasant and to pit every woman against each other, it just, you know, and then there was this objectification of men who got their oiled chests out. And yeah, it was fun, but it was very, very 1990s, that bit of feminism. So it had all of it technically, but it just didn't have enough heart for me.
But theatre, as much as anything else we're talking about today, it really needs bums on seats to even exist. So that sounds like a bad first sort of experience. But what are the other major West End shows that have a buzz about them?
The big ones, we've got Hairspray returning to the West End. Was something that I thought, we know this story really well. It's the sort of bums on seats that I thought I'm not going to get particularly excited about. Michael Ball and Les Dennis are playing a couple. Michael Ball's cross-dressing. But the energy and the pure sense of joy in this musical, the pure sense of joy, the astonishing voices. There was a moment when Marisha Wallace, who plays Motormouth Maybelle, it was a moment where she sung gospel. She sung, "I Know Where I've Been."
"'Cause I know where I'm going, yes, I do. And I know where I've been."
And this song, this gospel song, took us from civil rights era to Black Lives Matter. And her voice was so powerful, so full of emotion, was absolutely saturated with feeling that, you know, my 10-year-old niece, she had her mouth open next to me, and everybody stood up and gave it a in the middle of the show, standing ovation, which I actually really find annoying when people start, you know, giving ovations in the middle of a show. But in this instance there, if the show had ended there, I would have gone away on cloud nine. I woke up the next morning feeling elated.
Emma, for me and plenty of people that I know, the biggest TV event of this year is going to be the third season of Succession. Now, this is a blockbuster HBO show about a rich, power-hungry family that will be coming back to Sky and Now TV in October. I know you haven't seen it yet, but just from scrutinising the gossip so far, what are the early signs that it's going to be any good?
I think it's going to be great, you know. I mean, I've read sort of every piece that's been written about it. There's been a few behind the scenes, like on the set pieces, and it sounds very lavish. They've been filming in Italy and kind of in New York. They've got some fun guest stars, like I think Adrien Brody, and I think it's going to be kind of high-octane orgy of capitalist greed.
"He's our dad, but he was going to send me to jail. He'd do the same to all of us."
"Shiva, you okay?
Are you part of this family or not?
If I back you against Dad, you would need to let me take over."
I think if everyone's been missing their family over lockdown, this is the kind of thing to watch to make you loathe the sense of family. I think after seeing this kind of super rich group just go at each other's throats, I think it might be one of these sort of, yeah, water cooler moment shows where as each episode goes, like each week, I can sort of feel how people are going to be talking about it as it comes, which we haven't had for a bit.
Lots of people felt they've run out of new television to watch in the last year and a half. And it seems even telly makers have run out of ideas because they're just relying on a lot of reboots to fill the schedules. Are any of them worth watching?
No. I mean, it is, yeah, reboots are, I find them really sort of soul-crushingly depressing because I think it just kind of reeks of a lot of commissioners playing it safe. Like Aretha was kind of saying about, you know, theatre and the bums on seats. I mean, so the Gossip Girl reboot is kind of one of the bigger ones that's come about recently and has just been really flat, I think.
"Did you miss me? I know I've missed you."
It sort of feels like a kind of boardroom committee of execs have sat around and kind of said to each other, okay, what do young people want today? You know, the kind of Gossip Girl messages are on Instagram, DM, and everyone's kind of got their own slight edge to it, but it just doesn't really have the same sort of fizz as the original.
XOXO.
"Parents ain't around enough.
Gossip Girl."
There's Changing Rooms as well, which I used to love, which has come back.
"Open your eyes.
Oh my God.
Wow."
But again, kind of isn't as interesting, I think, as it used to be. I mean, Lawrence Roland Bowen is still kind of one of the designers on there, and he's kind of camp and amazing.
"We've got lots of MDF cut into weird shapes. It's like we were never away."
But Linda Barker's not on it anymore. And I think the original was so well known for, like, it's just constant sense of disaster. I mean, you can look at the kind of clips on YouTube.
"Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That is all that.
Oh, no.
That is all our teapots.
Oh, no."
But this one just sort of seems like a kind of so-so DIY SOS sort of vibe, and everyone's sort of pleased with it, but not really, and then the show just ends.
I don't know, Andy. I think we just have to put our hands up on this one.
Coming up, what has the entertainment industry learned in the last 18 months? And which of those changes are here to stay? Aretha, you've mentioned that theatre is about a lot more than its tourist-friendly crowd pleasers. And one of the jobs the industry has is to be reflective of the wider moment. What are the shows coming out this autumn telling us about the world that we live in?
There is a through line with some of what was starting up in an online theatre last summer following the murder of George Floyd, and you got a lot of quick response films being made about race, about the world today. I think some of that's continuing in autumn programme. You've got Winsome Pinnock's Rockets and Blue Lights on at the moment at the National. It's focusing on, refreshingly, Britain's history of slavery. You see so much in theatre, I think, about America's legacy, and it gives the impression that it didn't happen here or it wasn't a big problem here. And I think Winsome Pinnock's play exposes that lie. There's other plays that sort of feel quite dangerous, feel slightly anarchic, feel like they're exploring race and identity. White Noise, which is Polly Finley's play at the Bridge, is based around a set of friends who are very socially aware. And then one of them is assaulted by the police in a racially motivated incident, and it sort of sends them reeling, and there's all sorts of tensions that come to the surface. And it's about race in the 21st century from the perspective of black and white characters. I'm really excited about what's to come because it's clear that theatre hasn't just sort of come awake and thought, oh good, that terrible year and a half is over, let's just get back to business. They've decided to incorporate some of the meditations that they've had to have over the past year and a half with what's wrong with theatre, what's wrong with theatre audiences, how can we change this? And I think some theatres have really taken those lessons on.
Ben, the pandemic has given us a run of pretty introspective albums. I mean, you've had Billie Eilish come back with a makeover and a whole new mood. You've got Olivia Rodrigo, whose debut was a complete sensation. And then, of course, there was Arlo Parks, who talked to us on Today in Focus back in February about how she wouldn't even have got her album written and recorded were it not for being in lockdown.
Something that is exciting to me, and this is the way that I've chosen to look at things, is like people will have had more time to actually live with those songs. It will be, you know, rather than an album that you may have played for a month or two, it will be an album that maybe you would have played 4 months and that was even a soundtrack to one of the hardest periods of time in our lives.
What is it about these particular artists that is really resonating with audiences?
I think people feeling like they're just making something in their bedroom while we were not really able to leave our bedrooms. You know, there's just such an affinity there, I think, with audiences, and they've really sort of latched onto this highly intimate type of music. And I think Billie Eilish helped to sort of kickstart that whole trend.
I'm getting older, I think I'm aging well. I wish someone had told me I'd be doing this by myself.
Billie Eilish's record is really, really exceptional and as good as her debut.
Things I once enjoyed just keep me employed now.
Her lyrics are remarkable for their candor about the difficulties of fame, and you know, especially I think as a young woman, the level of scrutiny that she has on her music, on her physical body, is terrifying. Yeah, and we should mention Olivia Rodrigo as well, who is the pop icon of the year, and rightfully so.
I got my driver's license last week, just like we always talked about, because you were so excited for me to find.
Her album is, the second half is occasionally quite poor and perhaps does demonstrate that, you know, she is only a teenager still, but there are four truly outstanding 10 out of 10 pop songs on there, and they range from devastating ballads And then on the flip side there, you know, there are these pop punk songs that are just full of spunk and brio and anger and gossip, and they're so charged with the kind of power and life force of being a teenager as well.
Well, this sort of the impact of those young women takes us quite neatly into my question for Amar, because if you've read any sort of cultural criticism in the last couple of years, you'll know that so much has been written about brilliant female auteurs completely reinventing TV. Amar, can you tell us which ones to look out for?
Yeah, there's been quite a few. I mean, I feel like this is a great tonic to the kind of reboot dross, that there has been a lot of effort gone into commissioning fantastic talent that's been around for quite a while, actually, and it's now getting its due. I mean, Daisy Haggard, she's got a black comedy called Back to Life, which is on BBC Three. It's essentially a show about a woman who goes back to her sort of small town after having committed a crime, and she sort of spent 18 years in prison, and you slowly find out what that crime is.
Here's a tip. If you're going to kill someone, don't get a copper's daughter.
Thank you for making me feel normal.
It kind of veers from the horrors of her experiences as a teenager that led to the crime to then like just the sort of general absurdity of the world, really, and trying to kind of understand that from a perspective of essentially, yeah, an 18-year-old who's been in jail for such a long time.
OK, 6 weeks out. How are you coping with life outside the facility?
All good. I am on it like a car bonnet.
Well, I ain't mind that, Dan.
Then just say all good.
Huh.
And there's Rose Matafeo. He's a comic from New Zealand originally. He's been in London for the last couple of years, I think. And she released her sort of debut show called Starstruck.
Tom Kapoor is a famous actor, and you're a little rat nobody.
Harsh, but it's true. I am forever a stain on his sexual history.
I just found it like a really enjoyable, light rom-com, really, about an expat living in London, doing a series of dead-end jobs, who has like a one-night stand with a movie star but doesn't realise that he's a movie star. And then it's kind of about their slowly unfolding relationship.
OK, it's like one of those, you know, weird animal friendship shows where you see a Labrador and a hedgehog with friends and everyone's like, oh, that's not right, that's weird, but OK, if it works for them, great.
Yeah, but people don't think that.
And yeah, and I should mention as well, Mae Martin is another fantastic comic. They're second season of their show Feel Good, and that's all about their relationship with a straight woman, the kind of first sort of queer experience, and then trying to navigate coming out as non-binary.
I fell in love hard with this girl who looks like a little kidney bean.
Now, why are we under here?
I'm not sure.
So Feel Good is on Netflix, and Back to Life and Starstruck are on iPlayer. I have to say, I have no shame in the fact that I devoured at least Feel Good and Starstruck in single sitting binges when I was in quarantine. But talking about being stuck in front of your screen, Aretha, for much of the pandemic, we've been at home, unable to go to the theatre, but it hasn't stopped the industry from finding ways to get their productions to us. There's a lot of digital streaming, a lot of new shows to be seen online. How has that been working, and will we see more of it?
I'm really divided about online stuff. I think it's good, but I think it has paradoxes and problems. All the same, there's a lot that's been filmed or streamed. I'll just tell you a few. The Donmar had a brilliant revival of Constellations, you know, with four different pairs of actors. It's quite a complicated idea, but it's brilliant. It's about a show about love and death, and they're going to stream that. There's going to be the NT at home scheme, which I think people know about. It was free, do you remember, in lockdown? And we were all kind of euphoric because it was sort of all about accessibility and making it's really great shows free. I saw some, you know, I missed things like Small Island and I got to see it over the lockdown. Now you pay a little sum. First, I kind of thought this is a bit of a disappointment because there were old shows, but now they're putting on the newer shows. So Under Milkwood with Michael Sheen is going to be available from September. You're going to get Paradise, K Tempest Paradise later on in the autumn. You've got the Young Vic's brilliant scheme. It's called Best Seat in Your House, where, you know, Kush Jumbo's Hamlet is going to be streamed and you can have two views of it, the director's chair where you can control the camera or the more static sort of version. You've got Chichester Festival Theatre's really taken it on, has been streaming shows, will stream more. I think it's all for the good, but The thing with theatre is it's a collective experience. You go in for the collective experience. It's immersive in the sense that there's no pause button. What happens when you're given a pause button? What also happens when you're given theatre on a screen? Is it flattened? You know, the problem with online theatre is unless you spend a lot of money, where do you get these sophisticated sort of filming techniques? Now, I talked over the lockdown to the National Theatre about NT Live. One of those productions, those high-value productions, cost $300,000 to $500,000 to film. Hamilton was astonishing on Disney Plus. I don't know if you saw it during lockdown.
This is Hamilton.
You know, look at the camera techniques. Trillions of cameras. How much did that cost? So it's ironic. On the one hand, we're talking about accessibility, anyone around the world, people who aren't able to get themselves into theatre, but only the theatres that can afford it can put these productions out. There's inherently a sort of paradox about this great accessible thing. Do we want theatre on screen? Haven't we had enough screen time? Don't we love the buzz, the liveness of theatre? Isn't that what theatre's about?
I think there's that with live music as well. You know, at the festivals that I've been to in recent weekends, you know, there's this palpable excitement at being surrounded by other humans. That, you know, that feedback is incredibly potent. But I think also the pandemic and the sort of way that performing arts has had to adapt has created a kind of market for these kinds of streamed services that I don't think people were thinking about more deeply enough. You know, particularly I think it's exciting for music and almost you could argue environmentally necessary, that takes the carbon footprint of touring right down. I think that the problem is, are producers in theatre, are musicians thinking about these tools from the very beginning of the process, or are they kind of a means to an end? I think, you know, you can have an immersive screen-based experience that does exciting new formal things, but it has to make sense.
Ben, I have seen you throw some pretty incredible shapes on the dance floor before.
I thank you.
And you mentioned you've been to some festivals in the last few weeks. What's it like being back in a field surrounded by music fans?
I've seen it in these festivals, how moved the artists are hearing that wall of sound from the crowd again. I think the one that has really stood out to me is this artist called Self Esteem, who is Rebecca Taylor, formerly of a band called Slow Club, now doing a kind of solo pop project, although her live incarnation features an incredibly well-drilled set of choreographed dancers and backing singers. Look up. Her songs are all about womanhood and toxic masculinity. And yeah, she was overcome with emotion at the sound of the acceptance and love being beamed at her. And, you know, there were lots of women around me crying when I saw her, both at Green Man Festival and at Wide Awake Festival. And it's the seeing that feedback loop in process is really remarkable again.
Emma, obviously, you are here to talk about TV, which is very much being back on the sofa eating crisps.
My safe place.
Your safe place. What's your sort of cultural highlights on the TV schedules and how fuzzy are you feeling about them?
There's actually loads coming. I mean, this is the best time for TV, I always find, like the big autumn kind of blockbuster stuff running into then Christmas. I mean, aside from Strictly, which is obviously, you know, always great, Apple TV have got a good slate. They got the second season of Morning Show, which is Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon playing morning news anchors. So the second season of that's coming, which I think will be kind of really exciting and fun. And then there's also The Shrink Next Door with Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd. I think that'll be a nice kind of dose of American humour.
That sounds pretty up my street. We'll be posting the details of that show and all the other recommendations we've talked about on the Today in Focus page at theguardian.com. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Ben Beaumont-Thomas, Arifa Akbar and Amar Kalia. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.